afternoon. So last time we were talking about how viruses might work, and we talked about other places we could put virus code. In particular, we wanted to deal with real executable formats, which aren't as simple as that COM, just a blob of code and data that old DOS used. And we mentioned that, in fact, sort of many modern executable formats end up having these cavities. There's these unused pieces of the file, or unused enough pieces of the file, that we can put stuff in and not even change the size of the file, and potentially even have be loaded, be run, and so on. And we also mentioned kind of ideas for, we don't have to edit just an executable. We can also imagine that malware might edit libraries or system files or the various programs that run as part of the system boot process. Or they might have a separate executable and just arrange for it to run automatically in some manner. And we also kind of mentioned ways to have the virus code that we insert run. So we could replace the starting address, replace a jump or return, or we can look at kind of dynamic linking information and use that to identify opportunities to redirect things. In all these cases, we have to detect things to replace, but they typically have common enough patterns that this is plausible to do, especially if you don't care about being wrong a couple times, which malware authors might not care about breaking things as much as you might want them to. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so some assignment notes. I probably calibrated the difficulty of part B of RE2 too much. I like where part A went. That was what I wanted. Part B, there's two things that seem to be happening based on helping people in office hours and so on. So one is people are taking much longer than I expected to use the hint that's in the write-up that you should probably figure out how the function is called. In particular, figure out where the arguments come from, because that really helps narrow down how can you control what the function does. And the other thing is there's a few kind of bunches of irrelevant code people spend lots of time on, or do things that end up spending lots of time on irrelevant code that made this sort of much more time consuming than I thought it would be. The general strategy that I was kind of expecting is you find the function that does the output, figure out how that triggering function is called, and use cross-references to identify what's going on with relevant variables and figure out what argument values would influence that piece of code to run. And in some cases, that tracing is also part of the thing. What went on is that some people looked at that and said, oh, that seems hard to trace. I'm going to stop and do some other strategy rather than figuring out how this code gets run from the decompilation view and so on, and get down some rabbit hole where they're not looking at something immediately relevant. But yeah, that's where that is. So I'm sorry for miscalibrating that. I probably am teaching defense in the fall, so I will know to change this assignment. And as for grading, I'll probably be more lenient on the partial credit. That's why it says, tell me what you found out. So if you found out things that got you most of the way, or got you a lot of the way, or a reasonable part of the way, I'll try to give you credit for that. But you need to put it in your submission. You can't just tell me, yeah, I figured out almost how to do it, period. give me some evidence of what you found out. But with that, I will spend some time. I'm happy to spend time in lecture. Questions on the assignment? Things in the assignment. And I guess I may go over a solution to it. It would be next Wednesday. So no one wants to ask questions now. Okay. This is what surprised me, because part of why I asked on Wednesday is I assumed if it was really difficult, I'd get questions on Wednesday that would give a hint of that, and I didn't. But then I looked at how many things were submitted last night. Like, that's not what I was expecting. So, here we go. Okay, so if that's the case, we'll go on to talk about virus detection, which will be our big next topic, is virus detection. And I guess, and as I mentioned last time, like, doing this virus stuff, that's the following assignment. I hope that that's at least more predictable how difficult that should be. And I hope I provided pretty good hints for that. It's a little more difficult than the one I gave the last time I taught the course, but in that, the last time had one and two, and we have one, two, and choose two of three, one of the two versions of three. Yeah.
So I just wanted to ask like a clarifying question. So for the SQLite assignment, so when we're working in the terminal and we type whatever in the correct input that caused the malicious function to run, will the puts statement, will that be executed in the command line or in the SQLite terminal?
Where will the puts print? It will print to wherever SQLite is outputting. So if you enter a correct output, I'm saying a correct output because it turns out there's a lot of possible correct, a correct input. There's a lot of possible correct inputs. Then you'll overwrite that. Yeah?
If we, let's say we find the answer and we're trying to, walk through the process of how it gets called, are the temporary function names that Geezer comes up with consistent every time? DAT, whatever, will that be the same for everyone?
Question, is the DAT underscore and the fun underscore names the same for everyone? Yes, they're based on the address that function will be loaded at. In the case of this executable, because it isn't position independent. For a position independent executable, Geezer, I think, pretends it's always loaded at address 10,000 or something like that.
So is it helpful for you if we include those?
You can include those. I probably will recognize the function regardless of how you refer to it. It probably would be helpful to include that because I probably want my TAs to grade this, and I should not expect them to be quite as familiar. Other questions? Okay. So we're going to talk about detecting malware. And so let's, with that, think about this question. So we talked about a bunch of strategies virus-like malware might have. Let's think about which of these do you think would be easy or hard to identify without having many false positives. So I assume we're not going to identify these, each of these sorts of manipulation precisely. Like we might have some cases where you get fooled by something that's a legitimate reason to do this. Which of these do we think be hardest or easiest? Come up with an idea and see if you agree with your neighbor on what you think are kind of the ranking of how detectable these are. So, what do I have? So who has an opinion on one of these that seems easier to detect than most of the others? Anyone want to volunteer one they think is easier? Yeah.
I think replacing a function return is easier to detect because, right, if the function's not returning back to where it was called from, that's
okay, so you think this is easy. So I guess your idea is that if we're replacing the return, then we don't go back to where the function's called from.
Wow.
So that's easy to fix.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming we jump to the malware and then return.
Oh, yeah.
But I agree, if the malware doesn't return, yeah, big, gonna help. And the same thing with, like, for the start location. I'm assuming we start the malware and then go to the original starting code somehow. Because, well, you don't have to do that, but obviously that sort of thing is going to be a big, big red flag. Yeah.
G.
G? Okay. Because G, because we can...
We're assuming
that we can see what's running. Okay. And so why is that easier than...
Maybe I'm misinterpreting it,
but
like you could just see if something unwanted is
like
starting unwanted,
and you should turn it on. Okay. So, and how would you know it's unwanted? Like, what are you comparing with?
Well, I would assume you would just know what you want to be running, so it's just like unexpected
or... Okay. Yeah, so what you're getting at is, you know, we have a small list of good bootloaders. Small list of real bootloaders.
Sorry, I meant G, not that.
G, sorry. Oh, G, sorry, I'm being silly. Yeah, G, okay. So just assuming we have a list of good programs. Of good programs. That seems easier to detect. Right, because there's... It seems like there's not many of those to enumerate, so maybe that would be more risky. Yeah. Okay, so you think this would be hard to detect if it was properly changed? What do you mean properly?
Because as long as the bootloader actually like loads you into the OS correctly, at least I don't think it's being interacted with that much after. So it can be making changes to how like it's actually interacting with the system, but the OS might not be aware of like that the bootloader itself was changed because it's not like something it's monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just using the bootloader once it's already there, and once that change has been made, it's harder to undo because it just doesn't look into it as much.
Okay, so you're saying this is not usually monitored? Is
like, yeah,
not checked?
Working on it, I don't think
it is. So I agree with that. So I think the sort of the simple version of replacing the bootloader, I think if you are looking for it, it seems easy to identify because you read the bootloader and check if it matches the bootloader you want, which is probably one of a very small number of possibilities. Now, if the bootloader is manipulating reading itself by changing the OS, well, that's a problem that you're not going to detect. So you could do it stealthily, but there's some extra steps involved. Yeah.
I still think the start location would still be easier to identify than like traces of E through F, because there could be many functions and like libraries that could be like could have malware, but there's only one start location, like you compile a file.
Okay, so you're saying this is easier to identify, so this is, you're saying only one place to look.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty good advantage. Whereas for these other strategies, if we want to figure out is there a virus here, we're going to be checking like thousands of locations. And as we'll see, one of the limitations that's going to give us is if we want to do some kind of expensive check, maybe we can do that for every start location. We probably can't do that for every function call. other things that seem exceptionally easy, so exceptionally easy to detect relative to the others? So the other one I would argue is probably easy to detect is this one, because, you know, won't look like a, won't have the same machine code pattern as a normal linker stub. And those are very regular. Like, when you've seen them, it's like the same type of weird jump using the global offset table. If you see something that doesn't look like that, that's a pretty big red flag. So I think that's relatively, seems risky as far as if we're looking for it. So we're going to think more about sort of what makes viruses easy and hard to detect. And to do that, we're going to talk a bit about antivirus strategies. And then we're going to go back to talking about virus strategies that are mostly a response to the actual strategies we're going to use for detection. That are specifically things we're doing because we know there's detection software running. So for that, you know, we're gonna, you know, be talking about the game of antivirus and antivirus, or classic, you know, never-ending battle. And so we're gonna talk about anti-malware software. And I'll start by talking about kind of simple ideas for anti-malware, because that's what we'd like to do. And, you know, anti-malware software in general actually wants to do a lot of things. It wants to prevent the malware from running, wants to prevent it from spreading if it's self-replicating in some manner, wants to undo the effects of malware. And we're not going to talk about kind of all of these steps, but we're going to, you know, first start with kind of the key sub-problem that's involved in doing all of these things, which is just detecting the malware reliably. Like, we're not detecting malware just to say, print a pretty message, there's malware. We're doing it to actually act on that detection. But, you know, this problem of detecting malware is kind of a first step for all of these sort of actual goals of stopping it from running, stopping it from replicating, if it's self-replicating malware, stopping it, undoing its effects. We need to know what it was. To like reliably do that. So how can we do the detection? And maybe the simplest strategy is that, well, you know, pretty much all of these, except our bootloader one, involve changing some random files on the system. And there's a bunch of files we don't expect to randomly change on the system. So we can just try to detect, did files change? And probably the simplest example of like a way of doing that is an open source tool called Tripwire. And just as an example of a strategy you could use. So this is from about 2000. And it's a tool for monitoring and alerting on file and directory changes for targeted at servers with sysadmins who are worried about intrusions. And the way it works is you run the tool, it basically records hashes of all the interesting files on the system. You run it later, it checks those hashes and sees if they changed. And for some of our malware ideas, this is like, you know, what this like will detect all our scenarios. The problem is, you know, what do we do with that information? And what about the cases where there's a good reason for the files to change? And this is why this is not the strategy we can just use all the time. You know, when there's normal software updates, you somehow need to exclude them from that check and have, but still, you know, have that check be useful. The malware can try to, you know, there's files that are supposed to change that, you know, could say, you know, hold like a script or, you know, otherwise control what programs do. Maybe those files might hold the malware. The malware author's clever and wants to avoid this. And it also kind of relies on, you know, that our initial scan is a clean system without malware. If that's not the case, we're never going to find it with this technique. So another kind of very simple strategy, just based on we know what the files are supposed to be, is application whitelisting. That the problem with malware is we're running code that isn't the right code. Why don't we just list the applications we want to allow to run and don't run anything else? And for example, Microsoft has OS features that support this. App Locker is an example. There's also something called App Control for Business, which provides similar functionality. And basically the idea here is that if you are administering a bunch of corporate machines and you want to make sure no bad software runs on them, you just set basically a list of what's allowed to run. And you can do this by setting the list of software publishers that are allowed, where the idea is that software has a cryptographic signature. You just say who can sign it, or what file hashes are allowed, or what locations the software can be installed in, which you could presumably make be only restricted administrator-only directories that you like check very carefully. So this is a strategy, you know, that is very effective, that, you know, is probably impractical most of the time. Like, great if you can do it, but it, you know, it doesn't really handle the reality that, you know, users might want other software. Also, it's relying on your whitelist being accurate. If there's malware that exploits something in the software you did whitelist, well, you've probably lost. And also, the idea doesn't really handle scripting very well. If we think of like Python is designed to read files and execute them. It doesn't really fit into this scheme very well. The same is true for other kind of scripting language type things. Now, one place where this idea probably works better is bootloader security. So, a common feature of modern, not bootloaders, I should say, of modern UEFI BIOS is, yep, BIOS. So, it's a feature of the thing that loads the bootloader, which is the UEFI BIOS, is something called Secure Boot, where the idea is it verifies that the bootloader is cryptographically signed in some way to verify it's hopefully a trustworthy bootloader. And the hope is that the trustworthy bootloaders are not going to do bad things. That might be, given how complicated some bootloaders are, maybe that's actually a challenge, but this is, you know, largely the main thing we do about what about viruses that install themselves as a bootloader. Well, this is the primary defense we have for that. Yeah?
How can Secure Boot, like, work when OSs are constantly changing and there's always new ones and the BIOS is, like, vacant? What if you want to install some obscure Linux distribution? I guess you wouldn't be able to use it.
So the question is, how can this work when OSs are changing? So the bootloader is not the OS. So we can have one bootloader that is capable of loading pretty much every version of Linux. Yeah?
Is the
the bootloader is corrupted, is there a way of removing it, or does the bootloader just, generally it's stored on disk in a known location, so you just plug that disk into a different machine and, you know, and change what's stored there. So yes, but secure boot is not gonna do that for you, it's just gonna say, you can't boot from this. Does that answer your question? Yeah. You say you could, yeah. You say for replacing the bootloader, you can.
If you're doing it legitimately.
If you're doing it legitimately, yeah. So I guess secure boot has a way of not being turned off and flashing a new bootloader, even a custom one, because there is a mechanism for, and theoretically, for you to add a key to that can sign things that, like, is set up to require physical access to do. I say theoretically because people often don't like the complexity of the instructions for doing this and just turn it off. And secure boot also lets us kind of do some OS security stuff. So you could have a bootloader that checks the OS in a similar manner before loading it. And there are bootloaders that do that. Okay, so questions about my brief overview of secure boot, very brief. Okay, so these are all whitelisting-based approaches. We're basically making a list of the things that are okay, only allowing those. And practically speaking, this is not something we can do. Like all our software changes legitimately, we're not gonna have enough time to evaluate all the potential things that might need to be whitelisted. So instead, we're gonna try to identify things that indicate something is malware. And we're gonna create what are called signatures to represent this is the indication something is a specific piece of malware. And so we want to have some way of representing them, and we're gonna talk about ways we can represent the signature for some malware so we can detect it if it's present. And there's options here and kind of some goals we'll have. So one goal is that we want it to be compact, that people who make anti-malware software often has catalyzed like thousands of different varieties of malware. We don't want to have, you know, a multi-gigabyte database of signatures for that. We want it to be fast to check. Like, so when something is installed in the system, we want to, you know, not spend 10 minutes figuring out if it matches signatures. We don't have to do that, you know, kind of instantaneously, ideally. And we want it to be reliable. We don't want the signature to trigger on some piece of new legitimate software because of some weird, you know, coincidence that some number matched something else just by accident. So, to start thinking about this, what sort of thing should we do if I wanted to make a signature for Vienna? We talked about how the Vienna virus worked. What should a signature for that look for? What attributes of Vienna would we be checking for? Any volunteers? What things would we have to look for? Yeah.
I don't know how you would check this, but code that fills in like those cavities that we talked about, like those spaces.
It's code that fills. So you're saying, you're talking about signature for viruses, generally looking for things filling in the cavities. I like this idea. I'm just saying, let's just say I want to detect specifically Vienna, which was our DOS virus that appended itself. Just want to detect that. So that doesn't deal with cavities. I agree, like looking for strategies, we'll talk about that later. But we're going to start with simpler detection first. Yeah. Okay, so changed modification time. That's actually pretty great. Time. If it's marking, that's compact, it's fast to check. And I guess I should mention, there's two sides of reliable, actually. So there's one side of reliable, which is not many false positives. And there's another side that's a bit trickier, which is that we want it to sort of resist trivial changes in the malware. Because this is a cat adversarial game here we have, that the malware author is going to react to us trying to make a signature. And we would ideally like that reaction to not be really trivial. So this checking modification times, it's probably annoying for the Vienna author to fix Vienna and to not do that anymore in a way which will break our signature. So this is actually pretty good for Vienna. Any other ideas of things we could look for? Yeah. So, okay, so the jump at the very beginning. So that's compact, that's fast to check. I would be concerned about legitimate programs having one. But it is also, it is a lot of work for Vienna to get rid of that, but yeah. Other ideas? Yeah.
Could you look for the section where it copies itself?
Okay. Self-copying code, yeah. That's, we could look for that machine code, and that's pretty unlikely to appear elsewhere. Okay, so you have some options here. And pretty much all the signatures you came up with are, you know, aimed at detecting it without writing it, so I don't need to, but I'll allude to that another option we have that we'll talk about later is we can also think of ways of detecting malware while it is running, which is a different kind of thing to look for. And here we're detecting it by examining coding data. So we actually want to look for the, you know, some specific code and data. And so what we'll probably do is we'll take, you know, here's the code for Vienna, and I've marked, you know, this is what an infected file would look like. We have our jump at the beginning, and we have all the Vienna code here. I've marked with a C where there's a constant that gets changed when the virus is replicated. And so what we probably want to look for is the machine code corresponding to these constant parts. You know, something like that. And depending how specific you are, it's going to change how easy it is to evade our signature. So in the case of Vienna, like the obvious kind of signatures to come up with are like we can look for this code at the end, for example. We can look for this whole, you know, this whole segment of code, excluding this constant here. But when we're thinking of writing a signature, we're going to run into the issue that, well, people are going to come up with variants of this that are going to break kind of our trivial signature. So like the most reliable for finding specifically the Vienna signature would be just that we know the whole piece of code, we know where things change, we can just encode that, look for exactly that, But then when we have someone making a modified version, they're trivially going to evade our detection. So we can look for the start code like you mentioned. Yep, that's fine, but any real applications do it. We can look for the infection code. You know, that scans directories and finds files. That's fine, but you know, we're gonna have that code change if we're looking for specifically it, and there's probably lots of ways that can trivially change it. We can look for the code at the end that has that push and ret. Maybe that's little effort to change because you have to make it a variable jump. But because we mentioned why it was a push and ret, so maybe that's a pretty good thing. Signature, maybe not. I'll mention in our assignment about signatures, we're going to attack this pattern just as an example. But we have kind of an interesting decision in what signatures we look for. So we're going to want, you know, to come up with, you know, good signatures given our options. And kind of ideally, our signatures would like detect strategies that malware uses to do malware things. And we want that, we also want our signatures to be simple enough to be fast. So there's like complex ideas we might have is like run it in a VM and see what happens. Like we could do that, that's not gonna be fast, most likely. So we're gonna talk about applying probably the most common thing we use for pattern detection and kind of the basis for, you know, the basic part of pretty much all malware detection engines, which is regular expressions. We have these patterns we want to represent, you know, where we have basically strings we're looking for with certain holes and certain gaps and things like that. Regular expressions are going to be our way of representing that, and the specific reason why is that this is going to be a restricted language for specifying patterns that we can implement very efficiently. And in particular, we can implement it very efficiently while scanning for a big list of patterns. And this is what we'll use in an upcoming homework assignment. Now, in kind of real anti-malware software, that software will typically have a custom kind of pattern engine or whatever they would call it that implements this. I don't want to just have this be write configuration files for ClamAV, and I don't know of another open source implementation of such a thing. So we're going to use something that's not intended for anti-malware detection for an assignment. We're going to use Flex, which is a parser generator, but it's doing regular expression matching. Flex's design goal was to match like programming languages, like text and keywords and so on, but we can apply it to matching sort of anything, and it has a very efficient scanner once you've given the list of things to look for, which is basically what antivirus software is doing for the most part. It has a list of patterns, and it has this efficient scanner that can go through a file and have this big list of patterns and find all of them at the same time. So our regular expression language is we're going to write our patterns. In Flex, they're written as alphanumeric characters. In if you look at the configuration files for antivirus software, like so ClamAV is an example we'll talk about specifically, they typically represent it as hex values because they're dealing with binary, but we'll have to deal with characters. So for example, if we type foo, that matches exactly the characters FOO. For non-alphanumeric characters, we can match them with a backslash. And most importantly, we have ways of representing kind of things that could be multiple characters and also no, non-printable characters. And some of you, especially if you're checking DMT2, have probably seen regular expression stuff, so I'm going to go over, but I'm going to go over it because I want everyone to see it. So we have, you know, we can specify new lines tabs, we can specify a range of possible things, or a list of possible characters, or byte values, really. These are byte values, which will be important when we talk about machine code. And we can specify kind of any character. So you imagine if we're matching machine code, going back to our Vienna matching example, if I wanted to match this chunk here, I'd say, oh, you know, I have the move opcode and the thing that specifies the SI register, and then I have 2 bytes, which could be anything. So we can represent that. And also, there's support for specifying multiple instances of something, so variable size gaps of some sort, as well as multiple choices for something. And so this gives us a bunch of flexibility that, you know, is going to let us kind of express a pattern that matches a lot of different things, potentially. And this means that if we go through some human effort to write our patterns, we can match malware that, you know, has a lot of variations, and we can also avoid matching things that are irrelevant to what the malware code is actually trying to do, so at least they have to go through a little effort to break our pattern. So, right. Yeah, and we can match null characters, that's fine. Even though this is designed to handle C strings, it works fine with binary. So, this is what we'll end up using to do our matching. So, I'll talk about specifically how Flex works, because that's what we use in the assignment, and then we'll go back to applying it to our actual case of Vienna, you know, thinking about how it would work with that. So Flex, as I mentioned, is written for writing parsers, and it actually generates C code. So one of the reasons why it's efficient is that it's generating C code that goes through the input byte by byte and kind of hard codes all the list of patterns we have. So it's kind of like actually a very efficient parser for that list of patterns. Here's an example of a use of Flex. So up here, I have some declarations of some global variables. And here, I have my patterns along with code to run when they're matched. So each time we see foo, we're going to increment numbytes by 3 and add 1 to numfoos. Each time we see any non-new line character, we're going to increment numbytes by 1. Each time we see new line, we're going to increment numlines by 1 and numbytes by 1. And to run this, I have a main. I call this special function yylex, and that will read from standard in, write to standard out. Read from standard in, and do the pattern matching. Matching these as many times, matching these, you know, continuously in all the inputs until all the inputs consumed, and then I print out the final values of those variables. So questions? How this code works? So this gets transformed to C code, and then we compile that C code. Now, something I can do in this sort of matching identification code, is I can also examine the thing that matched in this variable yytext. So here, this will print out the word that starts with an A that we matched. And that will let me add other logic So we can see that this like would let us encode some special case rules if we wanted to do that. And also, because writing things like A through Z over and over again might be kind of tedious, or when we're thinking about our machine code, like writing the opcode for move over and over, we can define at the top kind of shorthands to use later. And what Flex is going to do that's going to make it kind of efficient is that it's going to make a sort of internally a state machine, and it's going to process the input character by character, tracking which state we're in. And when we have a miss, going sort of matching something and going back an appropriate number of characters. But it's basically going to write C code that does this. So like it's really kind of the minimum work you can do. And as we'll see, it can do this for a whole bunch of patterns at once, just doing the minimum one character at a time, no duplicated work. And we'll see, I'll skip ahead to example, we can apply this to our malware by saying, making our patterns match machine code we're looking for, possibly with like holes to fill in and things like that. So we'll talk more about sort of how the sort of flex, you know, why this is actually ends up being efficient code when we have a bunch of patterns to match. And then we'll, you know, go through talking about, you know, how some, you know, how this would work in kind of real antivirus software, and then talk about some non-pattern matching detection techniques. That's where I'll finish up today.